6. Samuel Rubin Imperium. From a Holzein the pocket communist in the mid-1930s to a creator of a new universe of radical left-wing activists and organizations in the 1960s and 1970s. Samuel Rubin gave birth to a 21st-century global girdling imperium that dominates America's revolutionary progressive socialist Marxist movement and remains a force majeure internationally. Samuel Rubin, a lifelong communist, and Philip Stern, whose uncle Alfred was indicted in 1958 for spying on behalf of the Soviet Union before fleeing to Czechoslovakia, provided most of the startup money in 1963 for the Institute for Policy Studies, IPS. Based in Washington, D.C., Rubin and Stern joined forces again a decade later to create an overseas star in the IPS solar system, the Transnational Institute, TNI, in Amsterdam. Rubin and Stern shared an abiding hatred of capitalism and, one may assume by logical extension, America itself. Yet, each benefited enormously from capitalist success. The Samuel Rubin Foundation that contributed most of the funds for IPS and TNI was endowed by the $25 million that Rubin realized when he sold A.C. Faberge, a cosmetics firm, in 1963. In Philip Stern's case, the original endowment of the Stern Fund came from the estate of Julius Rosenwald, the Sears, Roebuck magnate. The firms of Faberge and Sears, Roebuck were as American as apple pie in the 1940s and 1950s. In the hands of Rubin and Stern, however, their assets were turned toward the radical goals of destroying American liberties and enslaving its people into the service of the foreign doctrines of Marx and Lenin. The secret to the longevity of Samuel Rubin's organizational creation is rooted in assured funding from the Samuel Rubin Foundation that he established before his death, and the investment strategy and portfolio managerial acumen shown by his daughter, Cora, over the years. A third vital ingredient of the successes won by IPS and TNI was drawn from an unrelenting criticism of the establishment by the IPS co-founders, Marcus Raskin and the late Richard J. Barnett, whose driving force was fueled by a bottomless pit of hatred for American culture and government. And fourth, the IPS and TNI successes were drawn from the idea of social justice, which has long served as a guiding light for the radical left. It serves to silence anyone disagreeing with them and draws large numbers of dupes, dopes, and useful idiots attracted to its fantasy of creating a socially conscious world guided by socialist governance. David Horowitz, a former communist, shares his special personal insights about the real meaning of social justice. Far from being progressive, the left's demands for social justice, if realized, would destroy the very basis of social wealth. In the modern world, competition is not the contrary of cooperation, but the form that cooperation must take in order to coordinate the activities of millions of people unknown to each other, pursuing goals that are not common and cannot be shared. The profit motive is the engine of wealth not only for the rich, but for the poor as well. In the real world, the attempt to plan economic systems produces inefficiency and waste. The attempt to redistribute wealth diminishes well-being and individual liberty. The attempt to unify society crushes its freedom. The ambition to make people equal establishes new forms of tyranny and submerges human individuality in totalitarian designs. Together, daughter Cora, Raskin, and Barnett, plus Cora's husband, Peter Weiss, continued the creation of new strategic partners in Samuel Rubin's radical imperium. They were supported by an array of hard leftists, including radical labor unions, the religious left, radical litigators, a news media heavily tilted to the left, Marxist university professors, left-wing politicians, and an unending cacophony of propaganda voices from Hollywood bubbleheads. Together, these extremists who created and supported the Institute for Policy Studies developed broadly based policies and programs designed to transform America into a progressive socialist Marxist society and government. The IPS-TNI network attracts billionaire radicals like George Soros, Peter Lewis, Progressive Insurance Company, Ted Turner, and others, left-wing extremists in politics, labor, and social issues like Ramsey Clark, George Sweeney, and Jesse Jackson. Radical litigation centers such as the National Lawyers Guild, Center for Constitutional Rights, and American Civil Liberties Union, the religious left, including the World Council of Churches, Protestant and Orthodox, Pax Christi, Roman Catholic, and Tikhon, mostly Jewish, and foreign supporters in Russia, the European Union, and United Nations. These strategic partners contribute to, participate in, or lead radical programs orchestrated by IPS and TNI. The thinkers and tinkerers at IPS and TNI reflect a fluid mindset, one that defies easy definition. IPS and TNI have gone to extensive effort to avoid being labeled as communist or Marxist-Leninist and any other ists or isms from the left. Their creators play too smart a hand to show their ideological cards. At their base, the Institute for Policy Studies and the Transnational Institute are revolutionary idea houses. They adopt what works against the United States within their constipated progressive socialist Marxist worldview. Their perspectives are broadly based anti-capitalist and pro-socialist. The IPS-TNI vision of American socialism, according to the expert judgment of the Malden Institute's John Rees, is focused on which economic and social planning and control model would be best in carrying out the progressive socialist Marxist message at the lowest political unit, such as a city, community, or neighborhood. The economy would be dominated by small businesses. Public control would be exercised over major economic decisions, especially those taming the profit margin of large corporations in order to ensure human priorities are served first. From the beginning, John Rees counsels, IPS has been more interested in power through influence than in building an empire under its direct control. Yet, trying to define an agreed-upon IPS-TNI ideology is a bit like interpreting the shadows on the walls of Plato's cave. Just when one thinks he or she has it, the images change and a new form is presented. By flashing multiple images of themselves to outsiders, the IPS and TNI ideologues may have us believe they are open-minded, fair, and balanced in their thinking, projects, and reports. But, as always, the proof is in the pudding. The only pudding served at the dining tables in these two radical think tanks is a revolutionary blend of progressivism, socialism, Marxism. In IPS and TNI speak, progressive is a cover word for socialist, and socialist is the same as Marxist. Give them credit when it is due. IPS-TNI radicals have made progressive an accepted American euphemism for socialism and Marxism, both enemies of individual liberty and liberal democracy. For them, this is a great victory, for it is the first step toward reshaping the U.S. culture in a way that will accept a draconian shift towards socialism that will make Americans poor beyond their wildest dreams. Samuel Rubin, born in 1901 in Białystok, then a part of Tsarist Russia and now in Poland, Samuel Rubin migrated at age 4 with his mother and father to the United States. His parents opened a small dry goods store in a poor Jewish neighborhood in Brooklyn. According to contemporary propaganda, Rubin never forgot where he came from, and throughout his life carried memories of poverty, discrimination, and abrogation of human rights. Big words for a little man who plundered the dead and less fortunate in Spain during the mid-1930s. Samuel Rubin was the primary communist sugar daddy for the Washington, D.C.-based IPS and TNI in Amsterdam. In the hands of his daughter and son, Cora and Reed, the money Samuel made from his dirty deals in Spain was multiplied through smart investments, which provided more blood money funding available to the Samuel Rubin Foundation, which, in turn, kept both the IPS and TNI in operation as well as partner radical centers. In this way, Samuel Rubin's social vision has been extended beyond his death in 1978. Or, as he put it at the founding of the Transnational Institute in 1972, all you can have from me is perhaps a humanist approach to the problems that concern the people of the world. Rubin's humanist approach was to push the first bloodstained domino in Spain that set into motion a cascade of revenue for use by the left-wing centers in Washington, D.C. and Amsterdam. By assisting those guilty of crimes against humanity in Spain during the Civil War, including the Soviet Union's Communist International Comintern, its intelligence service NKVD, forerunner of the notorious KGB, and by the Spanish Communist Party, Samuel Rubin immersed himself in a cesspool of dirty money. Stalin provided the Spanish Republic with arms, ammunition, and other war supplies, including aircraft and tanks. But in the process, the Soviets defrauded the hapless buyers out of hundreds of millions of dollars. Exchange rates were secretly manipulated, prices arbitrarily hiked, account books cooked, and similar swindles in order to draw every possible shred of wealth out of the Republic. The Soviets forced the Spanish to pay for every aspect of their involvement, including the cost of transporting, feeding, and maintaining the Soviet advisors in Spain, historian Ronald Radosh and his colleagues recount. Meanwhile, they played with exchange rates and the cost of weapons to ensure that they spent every bit of the Republican gold and more. The Spanish Civil War was marked by atrocities on both sides, which does not speak well of either. However, the secret torture and killings by the Soviet Comintern, NKVD, and GRU, military intelligence under the cover of advisors to Spain's Republican Army, however, has gone largely unnoticed and underreported over the years. The NKVD built a secret crematorium in Spain in order to dispose of their victims without leaving a trace. Many of the enemies of the people selected for liquidation were lured into the building housing the crematorium and killed on the spot. Stéphane Courtois and five other European scholars joined forces in using documents briefly available in 1991-92 from the Soviet archives to tell much of the story. In 1936-39, the country, Spain, became a sort of laboratory where the Soviet authorities not only applied new political strategies and tactics, but also tried out techniques that would be used during and after World War II. Their aims were manifold, but their primary goal was to ensure that the Spanish Communist Party, by now run entirely by the Comintern and the NKVD, seized power and established a state that would become another Soviet satellite. To achieve their goal, they used traditional Soviet methods, such as establishing an omnipresent police force and liquidating all non-communist forces. The killing fields in Spain were filled with corpses of those slain by covert Soviet assassins. Spanish communists supplemented the Kremlin's strategy of liquidating all non-communists. Torture, rape, and horrendous depravity frequently preceded death for many. Summary executions were common. Two special prisons held members of the International Brigades, Horta District of Barcelona and Castellón de la Plana. The number of foreign fighters liquidated is difficult to estimate, but one executioner is reported to have killed about 500 undisciplined members, or those having oppositional tendencies. Thousands of Spanish children, ages 5 to 12, had been sent to the USSR where they were raised under the guidance of Soviet officials. When the Republic was defeated in 1939, most of the children's teachers were imprisoned for Trotskyism and others were sent to work in factories. The conditions in their colonies became increasingly severe. By 1941, about half of the children had contracted tuberculosis and about 750 of them had died before their trek to the Ural Mountains in central Siberia. Some committed suicide, others formed criminal gangs, and, when they matured, women entered prostitution. All told, some 2,000 to 5,000 Spanish children died. In 1956, the first 534 of the survivors were allowed to return to Spain. In the end, only 1,500 would be repatriated. The scene presented above is the one Samuel Rubin walked into in the 1930s to join his friends in the Soviet Comintern. Having emerged from the Comintern underground, Rubin surveyed the already plundered wealth of Spain's Republican government for an opportunity to enrich himself and the Communist Party. What he found was rather peculiar, although his earlier experience with a French perfumery enabled him to choreograph an uncommon means of war profiteering. The Republican government held a sizable stock of ambergris, a key raw ingredient used in the production of exquisite perfumes. Desperate for revenue for the purchase of arms and maintaining Soviet specialists in Spain, the cash-strapped Republican government decided to sell its large stock of this valuable commodity below market prices. With the undercover assistance of Spanish communists, who at the time were under Stalin's total control, Samuel Rubin purchased the ambergris. Communist ships ran the Italian and German naval blockades to deliver the Rubin's ambergris consignment to the United States. Needless to say, Rubin's profit margin on his initial offering of new perfumes and cosmetics in the American market was enormous. The perfume sales price also increased as a result of a suggestion by his friend Armand Hammer. According to some reports, Hammer had bankrolled and brokered the ambergris deal that Rubin called the new firm A.C. Faberge. Hammer had already stolen the Faberge name, with Lenin's blessing, many years before when he was dealing in Russian jewelry that had been confiscated by the Bolshevik regime. The jeweler of the Imperial Russian Romanov court, was Carl G. Faberge. He was famous for creating some of the most exquisite jewelry the world has ever known, especially the renowned Faberge eggs. Soviet archives, opened for a brief period in the early 1990s, confirmed what many in the West had believed for some time. Armand Hammer and his father were actually an official part of the Comintern's covert financial network. Reuben was no slouch in business either. Labeling his scents with dreamy names like Aphrodisia and Tigris, he soon turned A. C. Faberge into a multi-million dollar business. Through the 1940s and 1950s, Faberge, in effect, had become a laundry for the blood of innocents spilled years before in Spain. Yet, once blood it is on your hands, it never goes away. In Reuben's case, he had pulled a major business coup, but at the expense of Spain's Republican government, whose wealth was based on countless Spanish victims who had been tortured and murdered by Moscow's killing machine. The open question, since Reuben was a communist working with Armand Hammer, who was an official of the Comintern's financial network, is whether the International Department of the Soviet Communist Party, after the Comintern was disbanded in 1943, was an off-the-books partner with A. C. Faberge. If so, how much of its profits went to Reuben's benefactors who arranged the purchase and delivered the ambergris for him at the beginning? If the Soviets were silent partners of A. C. Faberge, what role may they have had with the formation and operation of IPS and TNI over the years? S. Stephen Powell's book Covert Cadre, 1987, presents several photographs of Soviet officials attending IPS functions in Washington, D.C. Why was IPS so cozy with the Soviets? Do IPS and TNI have similar with relations with Russia today? The CIA was curious about the IPS-Soviet relationship, sharing with the FBI that IPS potentially presents an excellent source of information for foreign intelligence services concerning U.S. foreign policy developments. In a March 1969 file, the FBI noted that individuals who have been identified as CP Communist Party members or sympathizers of CP activities have participated in IPS functions. IPS representatives have also affiliated with known communists. 4 months later, the FBI sent a letter to the U.S. Attorney General and Director, FBI, a confidential source, reported that on June 21, 1969, name redacted, she had accepted a position with the Institute for Policy Studies. Name redacted, described Marxist-Leninist text redacted, was also working at the Institute for Policy Studies and being radicalized by the Institute. Carl Faberge's family fled Russia in 1920 and eventually opened a small jewelry house in Paris and a craft shop in Geneva. Members of the Faberge family were dismayed after World War II when they discovered their trade name had been stolen by Samuel Reuben and used to make millions of dollars. They obtained a court-ordered injunction against Reuben. Afterward, it had become quite clear that Reuben's wealth enabled him to influence the legal proceedings. The injunction against Reuben was lifted in 1951, and eventually he paid the Faberge family $25,000 for the right to use their trade name for perfumes and toiletries. Although the Faberge family's financial condition influenced their decision to accept Reuben's payoff, they were upset that Reuben later used the fortune he had amassed to help set up the Institute for Policy Studies and Transnational Institute. The Faberges had fought against the Bolshevik takeover of Russia in 1917, only to be imprisoned, impoverished, and exiled. Reuben inflicted one final indignity by stealing their renowned name and using it to aid their tormentors. Samuel Reuben sold A. C. Faberge in 1963 for $25 million, the same year that the Institute for Policy Studies was created. And a year later, he put a sizable portion of his personal wealth into the newly created Samuel Reuben Foundation. The foundation's boilerplate simply stated, "The purpose of this foundation is to carry on the work of its founder, who pursued peace and justice and sought an equitable reallocation of the world's resources." The officers of the foundation included Reuben's son-in-law, Peter Weiss, vice president, who was active in the National Lawyers Guild, a communist front according to congressional sources, Cora Weiss, Samuel Reuben's daughter, as secretary, who was active in several leftist causes, and Reed Reuben, treasurer, Samuel Reuben's son who was named after John Reed, the first American communist representative to the Soviet Comintern, 1919-20. In a puff piece interview for the Washington Post shortly before his death, Samuel Rubin was in a self-congratulatory mood and sharing his thoughts about how a communist becomes a successful capitalist. Slamming the lust for the last dollar of profit, Rubin said that there's something else out there to life besides accumulating more wealth. The average businessman suffers diseases of tension and competition which rob him of the beauty of life. Yet, Rubin ignored that the beauty of life was taken from tens of thousands of Spaniards in the 1930s by his Soviet cohorts. He built a C. Fabrige on a foundation of corpses of simple people desiring to create a federally structured democracy to pursue their lives in peace and freedom. Many were betrayed and died shocking deaths at the hands of Rubin's friends, the Soviet and Spanish communists. Cora Rubin Weiss. Samuel's daughter, Cora, took over family control and day-to-day management of the Samuel Rubin Foundation following his death in 1978. Her husband, Peter Weiss, served on the board at the Institute for Policy Studies and pursued a long agenda of left-wing initiatives through the National Lawyers Guild. There is little personal information in the public domain about Cora, and even less about her brother Reed. Cora and Reed were red diaper babies, meaning they were the offspring of active American communists. The term was coined by communists during the 1920s as a criticism of comrades who appeared to use their birthright rather than their deeds to move up the ranks of the clandestine movement. Autobiographical profiles of 46 red diaper babies, particularly the children of Jewish immigrants from Russia and Central Europe from the late 19th century to about 1920, are contained in a 1998 book edited by Judy Kaplan and Lynn Shapiro, entitled Red Diapers: Growing Up in the Communist Left. By carefully sifting 46 childhood stories in the book for common themes, this writer found it possible to create a composite profile that characterized this first cohort of red diaper babies. We have no way of knowing how closely these themes, when integrated into a common profile, may reflect Cora Weiss' experience as a red diaper youth nor her attitude about today's world. But several stories that recur in the brief autobiographies are so strong and repeated so many times by those sharing their individual experiences that they may come very close to helping us understand Cora's contemporary worldview and penchant for radicalism. Many of the red diaper children remember their parents' passion for Marxism-Leninism and their dedication to restructure American society to be more like what they believed existed in the Soviet Union. Their mothers and fathers were seen as working for a better world, and they tended to keep their children close in order to protect them from American culture as much as possible. As children, the red diapers remembered the secrecy and need to ensure they did not reveal their parents' life on the left. Many were conflicted by trying to present a normal front, while always being fearful of being discovered and ostracized by friends and teachers. Parents were often too busy with their fierce devotion to the communist cause to deal with the insecurities their children experienced at public schools. Many red diapers were lonely and learned to lie at an early age about their parents' activities. Some remained seated during the recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance in school, while others stood and remained mute. They withstood pressures from their peers and teachers. When their teachers said the Soviet Union wanted to destroy the United States, many of the red diapers learned to bite their tongues to avoid a response that could expose or endanger their parents. Many found the FBI to be very scary, especially when arrests of people known to them occurred. They were aware of government surveillance and feared most an inadvertent betrayal of their parents. The experiences of the red diapers were not always gloomy and grim. As children, the red diaper editors Judy Kaplan and Lynn Shapiro pointed out, most red diaper babies learned that millions of people around the globe shared our aspirations for socialism, for a more participatory democracy and a more just distribution of societal resources. Indeed, in testimonial after testimonial, the 46 writers in red diapers expressed the privilege of growing up as members of the communist movement. The political values of their mothers and fathers were passed on through an informal process of listening to what was going on around them as their parents supported the communist cause. Many played with their friends at communist party functions. Most participated in some aspect of the formal process of being a member of the Pioneers, Youth Communist League, and the Communist Party, USA. Typically, the red diapers were proud of their parents and the devotion they showed toward a cause much greater than themselves. In adulthood, several red diapers said that they felt lucky to have been raised in communist families. Others said that they would not trade the experience for anything. Most were well aware that they were imbued with the same passion and social vision about ending the class system that had motivated their parents. With this broad composite of the red diapers, it should not be surprising that one of their number, Cora Weiss, has been railing against the United States and its policies all of her life. When her father died in 1978, Cora stepped in and carried the family's red banner to ever greater heights of radical causes and activities. The Rubin Foundation became the sun, dominating an ever-expanding solar system of individuals and organizations under the radical left influence of progressivism, socialism, Marxism. Cora exploded onto the American public scene when she and husband Peter visited Hanoi in 1969 during the height of the war in Vietnam. Cora Weiss was an active leader of the Women's Strike for Peace, a pro-Hanoi organization, according to a congressional panel, and it enjoyed full support of the Communist Party, USA. Upon her return from North Vietnam, she denied that Americans held as prisoners of war were mistreated. On one of her visits to Hanoi, Mrs. Weiss met with American POWs and reported their personal comments that they had shared with her to their North Vietnamese captors. So informed, the prisoners were tortured after she had left for their wayward attitude. Cora Weiss was very busy in subsequent days with frequent meetings with communist officials in Hanoi and Paris. As an anti-Vietnam War leader, she directed the People's Coalition for Peace and Justice and the Committee for Liaison with Families of Servicemen Detained in North Vietnam. The latter group was approved by the communist government in North Vietnam to serve as a conduit for contacts between American POWs and their families. Weiss attempted to coerce POW families to make pro-communist propaganda by promising them contact with their loved ones in Hanoi. Michael Trimmonley reminded us. None of the families accepted the arrangement. In addition, Cora did her very best to convince Americans that the prisoners of war were not being abused or tortured. But the POW's testimonies following their release, together with the visible scars on their bodies from the teeth-grinding torture by their North Vietnamese captors, belied Cora Weiss' plaintive bleats. In addition, the victorious North Vietnamese later executed more than 100,000 political prisoners, created more than 1.5 million refugees, and imprisoned more than 1 million people in the former Republic of Vietnam. The North Vietnamese were admitted to the UN in September 1977, which became a forum for Cora's giddy display of her lack of humanity. Ignoring Hanoi's trampling of human rights, Hanoi's blatant torture of American POWs it held captive, summary executions, and re-education camps in South Vietnam for millions of Southerners, often incarcerated for more than a decade. Cora Weiss shouted to the Vietnamese delegation, "Welcome in the name of the American people." Cheering by the assembled radical leftists continued while the four-member North Vietnamese delegation moved to the stage. One of them, Ngo Dinh, read a speech which excoriated what he called U.S. imperialism. Always careful to make a distinction between the American people, good, and American government, bad, Dinh said. From such a long distance the American imperialists send sick, 500,000 troops to wage a bloody colonial war. He declared in English, "Yet no enmity exists between the Vietnamese and American people." Cora continued her support for the North Vietnamese communists through the end of the war in 1975 and afterward. She was active through the end of the 1970s in channeling material aid to Hanoi through the Church World Service of the left-wing National Council of Churches. Once the North Vietnamese conquered South Vietnam, Weiss founded and served on the Interim Committee of Friendshipment, an organization established to send material aid to Hanoi and raise the issue of opposition to the U.S. embargo. After several years with Church World Service, Cora Weiss moved her focus to the Riverside Church, whose senior minister Reverend William Sloan Coffin was an anti-Vietnam War activist, where she had been selected to direct the Riverside's newly established disarmament program. William Sloan Coffin, under what can be termed only as being questionable circumstances, was elected senior minister in the summer of 1977. A longtime good friend of Cora Weiss, Coffin may have benefited from some of Cora's behind-the-scene influence. Whether by chance or design, a Soviet front group, the World Peace Council, was just beginning its peace campaign in the West. As soon as Coffin placed his new nameplate on his desk, he invited Cora into the Christian sanctuary. Officially launched in May 1978, the keys to the Riverside Church World Disarmament Program were handed to Cora Weiss. Rather than a celebration of Judeo-Christian partnership, the arrangement was more a pact with the devil. Coffin and Weiss had a close bond, owing to their activism against the Vietnam War, travels to North Vietnam, and work together at major activist organizations. For Coffin, one sin that preoccupied him most was anti-communism. This position was consistent with Coffin's view that communism is a page torn out of the Bible. Three IPS guests attended the World Disarmament Program inaugural at Riverside Church: Peter Weiss, Marcus Raskin, and Richard Barnett. Raskin, in good form, emphasized that relating morality to politics as being a good agenda for churches to lead the way. Coffin and Cora Weiss also invited two members of the Soviet embassy, Yuri Karpolov and Sergei Perimonov. Both men were identified as being KGB officers. Karpolov, according to well-known expert John Barron, was always seeking Americans who would communicate Soviet foreign policies and views as their own. The December 1978 soiree at Riverside Church must have gone well for the Soviets, since they became regulars at public events to cultivate their support. Soon, Soviet correspondents began to show up, many of whom doubtlessly had important espionage and disinformation agendas. This became a cozy arrangement for the Soviets. In September 1983, a Soviet delegation, Sergei Plekhanov and Vasily Vlanikin, that had entered the United States to attend a UN conference was picked up by a man and a woman in a car registered to Peter Weiss. Both men were under FBI surveillance. In between playing footsie with the Soviets, Cora took on the task of destroying the common American perceptions of the Soviet threat. Her position at Riverside Church gave her an open forum for making the case that the alleged Soviet threat was little more than a hereditary disease. By the end of 1979, some 156 left-wing disarmament conferences had been held across the country. But trends have a way of triggering counter-trends, even in the halls of faith-based institutions like the Riverside Church. Those members of the church who were committed against the arms race reported back to their congregations. IPS and Riverside shared vanguard responsibilities, while the disarmament program had begun to draw a lot of attention, especially since Cora Weiss' office budget went from $15,000 in 1978 to $148,000 in 1984. Some longtime members of the church began to question Coffin's and Weiss' activities. The deacons of the church backed Coffin and Weiss against charges raised against them. Meanwhile, the disarmament program began to bring in prominent speakers, such as Prime Minister Olof Palme of Sweden, Archbishop Helder Camara of Brazil, and former Communist Party member E. P. Thompson. European and American peace movements also participated in the program. Celebrities followed in 1983, including Bianca Jagger and the ambassadors from the Soviet Union and Nicaragua. Cora Weiss was a member of a U.S. delegation that were the guests of the Sandinista government in Nicaragua in 1984. Meanwhile, Coffin was banging the pulpit to love your enemies. Love means positive Christianity, not negative anti-communism. A Moravian bishop from Nicaragua, supposedly a Miskito Indian warring against the Sandinistas but in reality one of their supporters, also addressed the activists gathered at the Riverside Church. Solidarity with progressivism, socialism, Marxism has been an important part of the IPS culture since its inception. This became quite clear in 1985. Alexandra Sandy Pollock, a member of the Communist Party, USA, and U.S. Peace Council, an arm of an important Soviet front, the World Peace Council, met a tragic death on January 19, 1985, when her Cabana airline flight crashed en route to Managua. Although she was an avowed atheist, a memorial service was held for her at Riverside Church 2 weeks later. Gathered were some 600 party members, foreign diplomats, and others. Reverend Coffin said she may not have believed in God, but God believed in Sandy. Isabel Leitlier, wife of Orlando Leitlier, who had met his death by a car bomb in Washington, D.C., said, "As Latin Americanists, we know she will always be alive in our struggles." Henry Winton, Communist Party, USA, National Chairman, said Sandy drank from the fountain of Marxism-Leninism and was able to apply this science to everything she did. Jeanetta Cole, a member of Moscow's World Peace Council, said that Sandy as an internationalist, so it shouldn't surprise us that her life reached beyond us. A number of Soviets were present, though adopting a low profile. The Sandinista head of state Daniel Ortega visited New York to address the UN in November 1985 and took time to visit the Riverside Church where Coffin and Weiss had organized a reception for him. Addressing the assembled group, Ortega said that Ronald Reagan's UN Day speech yesterday was incompatible with the principles of international law. The audience registered its full approval. Ortega concluded by shouting, "We cannot afford to forget about what happened in Chile." This topic, the military coup against Chile's communist president Salvador Allende on September 11, 1973, is close to the heart of IPS, a theme returned to time and again. Cora Weiss maintained close alliances with religious groups working on peace issues in Nicaragua, including the World Council of Churches and the Interfaith Council. She integrated these interests with women's issues, including the August 1995 Conference on Women in Beijing. In May 1999, Cora, with the able assistance of husband Peter Weiss, created a multinational non-governmental organization, the Hague Appeal of Peace. More than 10,000 activists, government officials, and community leaders from more than 100 countries attended the five-day conference at The Hague. This new transnational organization, born amidst a great deal of hoopla, included some 400 panels, workshops, and roundtables that focused on identifying the best mechanisms for abolishing war and creating a culture of peace in the 21st century. Since many of the initiatives credited to the Hague Appeal of Peace are integrated with the United Nations, they will be discussed in Chapter 11, A World Without Borders. Suffice it to say for the present, Cora had launched a massive project that has already made telltale inroads into international institutions. In an address to peace educators in Hamburg, Germany, in June 2003, Cora Weiss defined the challenge ahead for the listeners and the Hague Appeal for Peace itself. "Now we must educate people," a code word for propaganda and disinformation, to put the institution of war on the table for delegitimation, for abolition, because the lethality of today's weapons, of nuclear weapons, is such that this precious little planet and its mostly wonderful people cannot afford war anymore. Peter Weiss, officer of the Samuel Rubin Foundation, chairman of the board of the Institute for Policy Studies, and board member at the Transnational Institute. Peter has been a principal architect of the Rubin Imperium and leader of its constellation of radical litigation strategic partners for more than four decades. Born in Vienna, Austria in 1925, Peter Weiss, a lawyer, specializes in international law. In the 1960s, he became a cooperating lawyer and vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR. For years in the 1960s and early 1970s, he was an officer of the New York chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, NLG, an organization of communist and leftist lawyers originally set up in the 1938 with the assistance of the Comintern and which remains to this day affiliated with a former Soviet and now Russian front. The International Association of Democratic Lawyers, IDL, whose Soviet roots go back to 1946. Weiss' other international work included an attempt to assist the radical West German lawyer Kurt Groenwald, who was arrested in 1974 and eventually convicted of running a communications network between jailed terrorists of the Red Army faction and their comrades who were still at large. In 1977, Weiss led a delegation to the Philippines to publicize reports of government torture of political prisoners that was sponsored by two fronts for the Communist Party of the Philippines, Friends of the Filipino People, and the Anti-Martial Law Coalition. Peter Weiss has a long public record of left-wing activism. In 1974, he became a member of the Advisory Committee of the Center for National Security Studies, CNSS, an organization whose founders were drawn from IPS, the National Lawyers Guild, and the self-proclaimed pro-Castro intelligence arm of the New Left, the North American Congress on Latin America, NACLA. In addition to the National Lawyers Guild, Peter served in the 1960s and early 1970s as a member of the National Council of another communist-controlled organization, the National Emergency Civil Liberties Committee, NCLC. I.F. Stone decided to create an activist committee that would prod the American Civil Liberties Union and liberal lawyers to take on cases involving current or former communists. He named the group the National Emergency Civil Liberties Committee. Irving Kristol of the American Committee for Cultural Freedom immediately exposed NCLC as a communist front. Members of NLG that directed the NECLC included William Kunstler, Peter Weiss, and Leonard Boudin and his partner Victor Rabinowitz. During the late 1960s and through the 1970s, Peter Weiss was also active with the American Committee on Africa ACOA, then the principal support organization for the communist-controlled African National Congress, which was waging a campaign of sabotage and terrorism to overthrow the whites-only government of South Africa. In 1979, he signed a letter from the Southern Africa Working Group urging the Carter administration to withhold recognizing the moderate black majority government of Bishop Abel Muzorewa. ACA was the first group to send ANC members to the United States to meet with black activists. IPS sponsored Ruth First in 1980, a Communist Party member of the ANC, to take part in one of its seminars. Ruth First was also the spouse of the ANC military's Joseph Slovo, second in charge of Soviet KGB operations aimed at destabilizing the South African government. In 1976, at the time of his assassination by car bomb in Washington, D.C., the director of TNI, Orlando Leitlier, a former high official of the Unidad Popular Unity, Marxist coalition government of Chile, was transformed into a martyr of the left. Peter Weiss continued his solidarity work for the Chilean left. Peter Weiss also was a hidden hand behind the international campaign to bring former Chilean president, General Augusto Pinochet, to trial as a war criminal. In the Covert Action Quarterly, Weiss contributed a full-page article entitled Punishing Pinochet, which outlined how Spanish judges were persuaded that they had jurisdiction over events that had occurred over some 23 years earlier in Chile. The Covert Action reports noted that Peter Weiss was vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represented the family of Charles Horman, a young American who died in Chile during the coup. The Horman family's lawsuit against Henry Kissinger and other high officials of the U.S. government was used primarily by the center to obtain, through the discovery process, classified U.S. government documents on Chile, U.S. policy, and diplomatic and intelligence reports on events in the country's political leaders, anti-Marxist Chilean parties, and Chile's military. The CCR charged that Washington's anti-communist foreign policies regarding the Unidad Popular Government made the United States responsible for the deaths of Allende supporters during the coup. Weiss and other prominent and influential members of the NLG, including Martin Popper, a member of the Communist Party, USA, who helped found both the National Lawyers Guild in 1938 and the International Association of Democratic Lawyers in 1946, founded the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, LCNP, in 1981. The LCNP's officers and consultative council were packed with IDL and NLG activists, including IPS's Richard Barnett. In August 1987, in association with the Soviet Lawyers Association, the LCNP hosted the founding of the International Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, ALANA, at a conference financed in part by the Samuel Rubin Foundation. The organization was created specifically to be in direct parallel with the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, IPNW, which had been co-founded by Soviet officials and hard-left U.S. physicians active in disarmament campaigns since the early 1960s. The organization's Peter Weiss was affiliated with also made up an interlocking directorate of an anti-intelligence lobby, which included the NLG, Center for Constitutional Rights, led by William Kunstler, NECLC, the ACLU, and Committee for Public Justice. Although labeled a Communist Party front in the early 1950s, the full extent of NELC's role was unknown to the public until the Venona Project was released in the 1990s. Out of public sight, the top-secret Venona Project conducted by American intelligence was decoding Soviet espionage cables. As early as 1948, the deciphered cables revealed that the Soviets had recruited spies in virtually every major American government agency of military or diplomatic importance. Hundreds of Americans, many of whom were members of the American Communist Party, were targeted by Soviet espionage officers. In all, the decoded cables by Venona revealed 349 citizens, immigrants, and permanent residents of the United States who had had a covert relationship with Soviet intelligence agencies. Marcus Raskin and Richard Barnett. IPS was founded in 1963 by Marcus Raskin and Richard Barnett, former White House and State Department aides. In order to make a case for shifting national priorities from the military-industrial complex to social programs, Richard Barnett grossly understated the Cold War nuclear and conventional threats posed against the United States and its allies and peddled paper-thin ideas for arms control that would entail taking great risks. Barnett's wishful thinking and under-the-table manipulations were combined in his disassembly of the defense budget. In the end, based on his false assumptions, Barnett discovered the economy of death could be substantially cut back to provide for the economy of life. All that was missing from his analysis about the real Soviet nuclear threat was some kind of reasoned assurance that enough Americans would still alive to enjoy his bomby predictions. Nevertheless, as Richard Barnett put it in 1970, the central task of American society is to free ourselves from the economy of death. 51 missing, however, was a rational blueprint for dealing with the nuclear threat posed by the Soviet Union against the United States and its allies. With the formation of the IPS, Raskin and Barnett set about organizing networks of progressive contacts not only in the U.S., including Capitol Hill and state and local governments, but also worldwide in many governments, executive branch agencies, and among leading academics. IPS placed its contacts in seminars with disarmament leaders and revolutionary activists who supported Fidel Castro's government in Cuba and various Third World national liberation movements backed by the Soviet Union. Together, they worked out alternative governmental policies for disarmament, termination of military alliances, and non-intervention against Soviet aggression carried out through surrogates. By 1978, the IPS had so penetrated Washington's circles of left-wing legislators, congressional aides, government agencies, academics, and the media that the IPS not only won stunning victories but also attracted fresh recruits. The FBI produced thousands of documents on IPS's activities. Some are available to the public through the Freedom of Information Act. The FBI withheld hundreds of documents. The documents collected by the FBI described IPS as a Washington-based think factory, which helped train extremists who incite violence in the United States and whose educational research serves as a cover for intrigue and political agitation. FBI File 175-398, or the RAND Corporation of the Left, and IPS apparently exercises considerable influence in the New Left movement and may have as its goal the destruction of the United States government. In this context, the mainstream media described the IPS in the 1970s and 1980s as follows: Wall Street Journal, a funnel for disinformation; Forbes, a radical Washington propaganda mill; National Review, the perfect intellectual front for Soviet activities which would be resisted if they were to originate openly from the KGB. From the beginning, IPS targeted NATO, the Defense Department, defense contractors, arms manufacturing companies, and the intelligence agencies for its propaganda and agitation. One of the first Reuben Imperium projects was to undermine and hollow out organizations that could expose their double agenda, namely the intelligence agencies. The Reuben Network did not mind being a powerful tool for the Soviet KGB, East German Stasi, and Cuban DGI. Philip Agee, a turncoat CIA intelligence officer, was a paid agent for Cuba's intelligence agency, the DGI. Another case was Klaus de Jonge, a Dutch communist and anti-apartheid activist who carried landmines for the African National Congress, turned out to be trained by the notorious East German Stasi. The most well-known case is Orlando Leetlier, former head of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. At the time of his murder in 1976, he carried documents showing that he was being paid by the Soviet-controlled Cuban intelligence. The DGI money was brought clandestinely to Washington, D.C., from Havana via the Cuban diplomatic pouch. Act Globally, Learn Locally opens the catalog to the IPS schoolhouse in Washington, D.C. The Social Action and Leadership School for Activists, SALSA, serves as a left-wing center with a skills training program that strengthens community activism and fosters engaged citizenship, a forum for discussion and development of progressive issues and agendas, and a unique networking opportunity to social change activists. The Winter 2001 schedule, for example, offered courses in the ABCs for creating nonprofit organizations, leadership and management, developing a media strategy, grant writing, accounting, and internal controls. cultivating major donors, lobbying, grassroots organizing, and a few policy issues. The idea is to equip the student with new skills and assist in refining their thinking and advancing the progressive cause. Marcus G. Raskin, co-founder of the Institute for Policy Studies, is the intellectual leader of those dedicated to restructuring American life and institutions in preparation for the global civil society that lies ahead. Raskin tells us that he began his political and intellectual life as a liberal, which was reinforced during his growing years by what he called the sewer socialism of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. An advisor to Congressman Robert Kastenmeier in 1959, Raskin prepared a political screed for 12 ultra-liberal members of the U.S. House of Representatives. The liberal papers were to be used to move the Democratic Party back on a track that would simultaneously finish the New Deal program, which had been left undone by President Truman. At the same time, the papers would correct the turn taken by liberals to support national security initiatives during the Cold War of the 1950s. The latter area was centered on a host of unilateral disarmament and diplomatic disengagement areas that would leave the United States and its allies exposed to Soviet nuclear forces, while protected by the Raskin's liberal dream that the Kremlin would respond in pacific ways. The liberal papers, published in 1962, argued that U.S. Cold War foreign policies were responsible for destroying the domestic political tasks defined by the New Deal program. In order to get back to the liberal pathway laid out by the New Deal program, therefore, the U.S. had to modify its Cold War foreign policy significantly. Raskin's problem, however, is that there was no indication that the Kremlin had any other objective, as Soviet Chief Nikita Khrushchev said at the time, than to bury the United States, and he had the nuclear weapons to do so. Hence, the U.S. needed to maintain a strong nuclear deterrent, and the sweet dreams of the New Deal program became just that, a dream held by pathetic, baggy-pants liberals who looked at reality and said in a childlike manner, "I don't want it. Their socialist fantasy to be over." Marcus Raskin would have been well advised to gird up his loins, as President Teddy Roosevelt was fond of saying, or playing children's games in what he called the sewer socialism of Milwaukee. He did neither. He got angry. He refused to support the U.S. government's fight for survival during the Cold War. The papers, Francis X. Gannon observed in 1969, were devoted exclusively to foreign policy and reflected abject appeasement with communist powers, extravagant extensions of foreign aid programs, reckless disarmament proposals, and groveling obeisance to the United Nations. It was capitalist interests growing in the national security state, as he and his ilk would define the United States. 2 decades later, when journalist John Train asked a well-known columnist about what motivated Marcus Raskin, he responded, "I know him well, but I don't know the answer to that question. I guess he just hates America." In 1961, Raskin met another malcontent, Richard Barnett, at a White House Department of State meeting in preparation for a disarmament conference in Geneva. Both men said that from the time their eyes first met, they knew they were kindred spirits. Raskin was at the meeting representing McGeorge Bundy, a member of a special staff of the National Security Council. Barnett was supporting John J. McCloy, head of the State Department's disarmament office. According to stories attributed to Barnett and Raskin over the years, they recognized each other's alienation and hostility toward the American Brain Trust gathered for the meeting: Dean Rusk, Paul Nitze, John McCloy, and a long row of generals. These two aides, given the honor to serve their country in protecting itself against hostile, dangerous powers, were not up to the task. In the end, they saw themselves superior to the senior officials for whom they worked and held them in contempt. A wise investigative journalist for many years, John Rees, noted that the ancient Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu made note of such arrogant junior officials almost 2,500 years ago, and suggested that those chafing with resentment are good prospects for recruitment as agents. Those of us having had the privilege to serve the U.S. government during the Cold War were well aware that those of our countrymen who positioned their intellect above others and felt superior to their peers were among the most dangerous people in Washington, D.C. By putting themselves above all others, these ego-driven self-lovers could be enticed to make the wrong decisions for the wrong reasons. In a world of nuclear weapons, such persons posed a threat to all Americans. Raskin and Barnett stayed with the Kennedy administration until 1962. By that time, they had pretty well lined up the resources needed for creation of a think tank of the left to be launched in 1963. Rooted in the unfulfilled program of the New Deal as expressed in the liberal papers and a strong dosage of socialism, the IPS core philosophy was centered on two ideas. First, that the bureaucratic process of government smothered fresh political ideas and moral truths to the degree that government became unresponsive and destructive. And, secondly, that universities insisted on keeping social action and social theory distinct, which resulted in false ideals. Hence, IPS was to become a place where no government funds would be taken and where social theory must be informed by, as well as inform, social action. Raskin and Barnett brought their own unique worldviews to the IPS table where they were integrated into cohesive social theory and social action programs. Raskin described the United States as an imperialist country made up of four colonies that the poor and young had come to see as their primary enemy. The four colonies imagined by Raskin included the violence colony, which was most important, for it was the central element that used the university as a terrorizing element of the state. The plantation colony was said to produce unreal work that fed human wants but did not satisfy needs. Meanwhile, the channeling colony was really the education system that promoted the passive acceptance of other colonies by the dream colony. Finally, decolonization was a major goal pursued by Marcus Raskin, Richard Barnett, and their colleagues at IPS. The key to understanding the Institute for Policy Studies has been for many years and remains the dismantling of the national security state, including pulling down America's militarist economy and threats and provocations posed against other countries. In Raskin's worldview, all decisions in a reconstructed society will be made face-to-face in local meetings. In short, the reconstructed society, as Rael Jean Isaac summarizes Raskin's outlook, is an anarchist syndicalist federation of autonomous cooperatives. Since present human imperfection is wholly attributable to the colonizing agents, in Raskin's utopia there will be no hierarchy, no coercion, no real organization beyond the local level. The Institute for Policy Studies uses international subsidiaries, strategic partners, and cooperative arrangements to extend its reach directly overseas. The most prominent research centers abroad, however, is its sister organization, the Amsterdam-based Transnational Institute. This close relative is also a think tank on the left. Together with IPS, TNI brings together radical labor organizers, leaders of support networks, left-wing activists operating from non-governmental organizations, revolutionary terrorist groups, leaders of the peace and disarmament movements, and radical and liberal academics, journalists, foreign officials, politicians, diplomats, intelligence officers, and representatives of parliaments. Iqbal Ahmad and Susan George. One of the Transnational Institute's most important tasks from the first day of its creation was protecting IPS's respectability by providing a cover for IPS's relations with the international communist movement. Susan George, a longtime fellow of TNI and its director in 2008, organized an IPS dinner in Paris on October 9, 1972, to discuss ideas shared by several European intellectuals about TNI's potential activist agenda. The foremost item on the agenda was the creation of TNI as an overseas extension of IPS. Peter Weiss, Marcus Raskin, and Richard Barnett were present. Among the prominent members of Europe's radical left was Roland Barthes, Simone de Beauvoir, Claude Bourdais, Michel de Foucault, André Gorz, Claude Julien, and Jean-Paul Sartre, who wrote an extensive preface for the terrorist Frantz Fanon in his book, The Wretched of the Earth. A similar meeting was held at the Café de Paris on London's Regent Street. TNI was to become one of the Rubin Imperium's most powerful tools. Samuel Rubin pledged $4 million in startup funding for TNI. Philip Stern, a millionaire Maoist and a trader in real estate, also was a donor. Ed Jantz, a philanthropist and underwater photographer in California, sold TNI a large building at the Paulus Potterstraat 20 in Amsterdam. TNI was established there in 1973 and has served ever since as the international arm of IPS. Amsterdam was not only chosen because of its central location in Europe, but also because it has an aura of tolerance. In addition, the Dutch government had been closely aligned with Chile's Allende regime and social movement. For the left, TNI began as an Allende backlash. Samuel Rubin and the other powers at IPS chose the right person when they tapped Eppel Ahmad to serve as TNI's first director in 1973. Ahmad combined a superior intellect and record of scholarship in support of Arab extremism with the practical matters of revolutionary warfare and terrorism in the Third World. He held a PhD from Princeton University and had taught at the University of Illinois in Chicago and Cornell University. From 1960 to 1963, he worked with Frantz Fanon, leader of the Algerian National Liberation Front, and LEF, who was known in many circles as the Che Guevara of the Middle East. Fanon, a self-described creative extremist, became Ahmad's mentor in the business of revolutionary terrorism or waging an intense killing campaign against ethnic French and Algerians opposed to the Front's terrorist war. 61 Eppel Ahmad. One can assert with confidence. Got a considerable amount of blood on his hands from Fanon's murderous campaign before he served as a member of the Algerian delegation to the peace talks with France at Paris and secured Algeria's independence in 1962. Eppel Ahmad's TNI was developed with a strong dedication to the extremist goals and actions of the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, and its leader Yasser Arafat. Since some potential funding sources might take exception to the IPS relationship with the PLO and other terror groups, the Middle East Research and Information Project, MERIP, was founded in 1971 as a cover for the Institute's shadow world activities. By 2004, MERIP's Middle East report was being published four times a year from the editorial office in Washington, D.C. It is a clean publication with no easily discernible linkage to IPS or TNI. MERIP's media outreach program extends progressive socialist Marxist thinking on the Middle East through a variety of print, radio, and television resources. Fred Halliday, a TNI advisor, is one of the MERIP report's contributing editors. During the Soviet-Afghan War, Fred Halliday was one of the rare Western journalists allowed to enter Afghanistan to report on the war. It was for good reasons that the IPS TNI fellow Halliday received such special treatment. Following the Soviets' December 1979 invasion, Halliday wrote several articles in MERIP's reports and magazines, The Nation, and New York Times that rationalized the Kremlin's actions. Samuel Rubin, daughter Cora Weiss and her husband Peter, and IPS founders Marcus Raskin and Richard Barnett gave Ahmad a full mandate to set up TNI. In early 1973, Ahmad was sent across Europe by IPS on a five-week trip to discuss the TNI project with some 200 European thinkers and activists drawn from a wide spectrum of the left. His discussions included those involved in peace and disarmament issues, solidarity in the Third World between terrorists and national liberation movements, women's rights, minority rights, and combating transnational corporations that exploit the resources of Third World countries. The message was clear that TNI's door was open and would stay open to all those involved in the fight against imperialism and for social and economic justice. In an interview in a Dutch newspaper in 1973, Ahmad mentioned that the new institute will not be comparable with any other Dutch institution. It will concentrate on scientific research and social action. Left. Clear. Internationally known left intellectuals will walk in and out. Everybody, Ahmad said, who is against imperialism and for social justice, is welcome with us. Communists, Trotskyists. We are not sectarian. TNI's first major conference on Chile was organized in 1974, following the overthrow of Marxist President Salvador Allende. In the wake of the September 11, 1973 military coup, TNI and IPS built close working relationships with concerned progressive socialist Marxists. The big issue in the eyes of the extreme left then and today is that Allende gained the presidency through the ballot box. But, because of his Marxist ideas and programs and friendship with the Soviet Union, he was turned out by the military. Allegedly with outside U.S. assistance. The 1973 military coup in Chile is seen by IPS extremists as a rehearsal by the ruling corporate capitalism system in the event progressive socialist Marxists accede to power in the future. Since the radical left generally follows Antonio Gramsci's counsel to set up a transformational revolution by changing a target society's values over time, the specter of a violent response is very bothersome to them. Hence, the IPS TNI elite have grasped the coup against Allende for more than 30 years as if the events were a powerful worry stone for the radical left. By the time Helen Hoppe, Marcus Raskin, and Iqbal Ahmad went to the Netherlands in July 1973 to initiate TNI's operations, IPS already had found research fellows in the Netherlands, including Dr. Ernst Utrecht, publicist and Indonesian specialist, and Gerrit Huizer, who taught at the University of Nijmegen on third world problems. Huizer took care of the IPS people from Washington and coordinated the contacts with several other organizations. Ahmad organized TNI to serve as a bridge between IPS and revolutionary communists in the Third World. In the end, his bridge building may have also included those who were to become Al-Qaeda Islamists. Ahmad first met Osama bin Laden in 1986. Iqbal Ahmad used the phrase, first met bin Laden, clearly inferring there were meetings with Osama after 1986 in a presentation at the University of Colorado in October 1998. At the time, he was explaining in his unique low-key manner why Osama bin Laden felt betrayed by the United States for retaining military forces in Saudi Arabia to patrol the no-fly zones over Iraq after the 1991 Gulf War. Ahmad grossly ignored bin Laden's attacks against Americans in a feckless effort to retain some coherence to his faulty line of argument. Iqbal Ahmad died on May 11, 1999. Susan George has been a fellow and intellectual guide of the Transnational Institute since its founding in 1973. She is one of the intellectual superstars of the anti-globalization movement in Europe and the United States. She also plays a key role as a thought leader and activist in the Global Days of Action called for by the People's Global Action, the primary coordinator of the left-wing movement against international financial and trade institutions, example, World Bank, World Trade Organization. She also compares the market economy to a malignant tumor. In an April 2007 speech to graduates of Spain's Universidad Nacional de Educación a Distancia, a distance learning institution with 180,000 students, she explained TNI's worldview and action programs for the future. Since we are progressives, she said, our views are usually ahead of their time and are necessarily unpopular with many political adversaries. She cited as an example the far-right forces in the United States encouraging students to monitor professors they consider too far to the left. She cited David Horowitz's book The Professors that unveils the activities of the 101 most dangerous professors in America. I do not need to remind you, George continued, that obscurantist forces, often religious, are also at work in Europe. Susan George explained that at TNI they believe action is an integral part of our lives as intellectuals. We call ourselves scholar activists. TNI intellectuals research, write, and publish, but we also intervene in public debates, she explained. We are active in the social movements of our own countries and often internationally as well. From the start, disarmament was one of TNI's main programs in cooperation with its TNI fellows heading Britain's major anti-nuclear campaign for nuclear disarmament, CND, and European Nuclear Disarmament Organization, END, in Washington, including Michael Clare and Richard Barnett, in an extreme European network. Researchers from the Netherlands, West Germany, England, France, Italy, Spain and Denmark met regularly in Amsterdam at international conferences on such topics as NATO and the Soviet threat. The Swedish Research Center SIPRI participated in the conferences. The Transnational Information Exchange, TIE, established in 1978, is a network of research organizations working on better understanding the strengths and weaknesses of transnational corporations in several European countries. Initially, TIE was created to simply exchange information between research entities. Over time, however, its work became focused more sharply on the discussion between transnational corporations in Europe and the rest of the world, including dialogue between trade unions and other workers' organizations. The main objective was to encourage development of positive and practical alternative strategies within the labor movement in dealing with cross-border industries. The first consultations, for instance, were focused on the auto industry, 1979, and telecommunications, 1980. As early as the 1980s, IPS and its Europe-based sister entity, TNI, were beating the drums of left-wing dogma about transnational corporations and their vast wealth, power, and ability to cross national borders. The Thai's definition of transnational corporation issues expressed 25 years ago in the years of data collection and analysis on specific industries are being echoed in the radical left's anti-globalization campaign early in the 21st century. The following mid-1980s quotation, for instance, could have been heard at the 2008 anti-globalization protests in Europe and North America. The global corporations have devastated communities in the developed countries by shutting down dozens of plants when more profitable investment opportunities appeared elsewhere. As unions have increasingly learned in recent years, strikes against large corporations by workers in one country alone can be rapidly undermined by corporate shifts of capital to workplaces abroad where workers labor at similar levels of productivity for substantially less pay. For the third world, the growth of global corporations has meant more consumer goods for the rich, but deepening poverty for the majority of people. Nor have the hundreds of billions of dollars lent by large banks translated into development. Instead, many developing countries are suffering the horrors of austerity that accompany massive debts. Among those credited for their contributions to the above-referenced Thai report were John Kavanaugh, then a TNI fellow and now director of IPS, and Susan George, now director of TNI. Anti-globalization certainly is not a new phenomenon. It has served at the core of international socialism for many years. The TIE, with the active support of TNI and the World Council of Churches and other faith-based organizations, remains at the forefront of the renewal and re-emergence of Marxism in the post-Cold War world. From the beginning, the World Council of Churches has collaborated with Thai and TNI on gaining a better understanding of the advent of transnational corporations and their creation of a global marketplace. From the perspective of the World Council of Churches, a hard-left entity with a Soviet KGB agent on its governing board, Thai was a group of European centers of Christian inspiration who look attentively at what TNCs, transnational corporations, are doing in Western Europe and the consequences of this action. In a letter to the World Council of Churches supporting organizations in March 1982, Julio de Santa Anna wrote, "Thai has given evidence of being in solidarity with victims of TNCs." Based on that premise, de Santa Anna argued that European churches should be given the opportunity to support the Thai program of investigating the actions of the transnational corporations. The Transnational Institute adapted to the post-Cold War world by reorganizing its study and activist agendas in the Third World. Three strands of thought, when taken together, were expected to identify obstacles to social and economic justice, uncover causes of insecurity, conflict, and war, and develop new ideas of political economy that will change the terms of debate on the interaction of the natural environment and the economy. These three strands of thought and action at TNI became central aspects on the international radical left's agenda guiding the anti-globalization movement that began with the Zapatista challenge to the government of Mexico on January 1, 1994, the first day of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The international left drew a line in Mexico and then burst into the headlines in Seattle during the December 1999 protest against the World Trade Organization. While TNI was reorienting itself for future challenges in the post-Cold War, one of its long-standing fellows, Joel Rocamora, faced a different kind of problem. He had guided TNI's support for radical leftists in the Philippines for many years. But he sent a letter to dear friends on TNI letterhead on October 8, 1992, explaining a dilemma he faced. "Yesterday, I received my walking papers. After having devoted over 20 years of my life to the revolutionary struggle as a member of the Communist Party of the Philippines, I have just been expelled from the organization. My expulsion appears to be part of a wide-scale Stalinist purge that the party leadership has decided to launch under its so-called rectification campaign." Incidentally, TNI's Philippine project received a core grant of $130,000 annually from the Samuel Rubin Foundation for many years and grants from the European community of around $40,000 to $50,000. IPS and TNI assumed central roles in the large anti-globalization protests in 1999. Protests in Europe and North America against neoliberalism grew in size and scope over time, and eventually the radical organizers found themselves intertwined with the anti-war movement against the post-September 11 U.S. military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. The fellows of the Transnational Institute are among the best and brightest of those on the revolutionary left. One of those persons is Susan George. She is deeply involved in the movement for global justice, the Anti-Globalization Project, and George previously served as the vice president of Attac France, a Paris-based association for the taxation of financial transactions to aid citizens. That still serves as a thought center for the World Social Forum. 73 during the latter days of the Soviet Union, Susan George reportedly met with Mikhail Gorbachev several times in Moscow. Together with other left-wing organizations under TNI's guidance, the Western participants strongly urged the Soviet leader to focus on environmental issues as a means of slowing U.S. armament programs and economic growth. The idea was to help Moscow during its economic and political restructuring in the days just ahead. Other core IPS and TNI players. John Kavanaugh. He has been one of Cora Weiss' most important field soldiers for many years. While working as an international economist with the UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, and the World Health Organization in Geneva in the early 1980s, he kept close contact with the Weiss Network. In a January 1982 letter to Jeroen Pijnenberg of TNI's Transnationals Information Exchange, TIE, Kavanaugh feathered his future employment nest by volunteering his services and gathering UNCTAD documents needed for TIE's radical economic research and shipping them to Pijnenberg. A year later, John Kavanaugh was an IPS fellow and a member of the Board of Advisors for Counterspy, CIA defector Philip Agee's magazine that exposed American and British undercover agents. At least one U.S. intelligence officer was murdered, possibly from the Agee-Kavanaugh exposure, and many others were placed in jeopardy. Kavanaugh's talents were recognized early, and he moved quickly up the IPS ladder to become director of the Institute. John Kavanaugh's single most important activity as director was the caring for and feeding of 70-plus members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. The caucus, whose members served in important positions in the U.S. House of Representatives, pursued an agenda that fit quite comfortably with the IPS goal of restructuring U.S. society along progressive socialist Marxist lines. All but Senator Bernard Sanders, a declared socialist from Vermont, are Democrats. John Kavanaugh performed many other high-profile projects and tasks serving as director of IPS, but his first love for many years has been the rise of corporate global power. Here he could get his teeth into the anti-people monster he sees as having been unleashed upon the world by greedy capitalists. Kavanaugh's primary concern has been in producing propaganda campaigns against transnational corporations. As is the case with many progressive socialist Marxists, truth is the first casualty in their heavily slanted analyses specifically designed to promote key propaganda points. Nowhere is Kavanaugh's hatred of corporations more evident than in Meeting the Corporate Challenge, a 1985 ideologically motivated, progressive socialist Marxist handbook against these capitalist profit makers. The Transnational Information Exchange published the book, and John Kavanaugh served as the lead editor of the project. The Institute for Policy Studies, said by many to be the international driving force of the anti-corporate movement, combines the resources of its own Transnational Resource and Action Center, TRAC, with its overseas arm, the Transnational Institute. The IPS propaganda factories concerning the operations of transnational corporations include Corporate Watch, CorpWatch, a subsidiary of TRAC. The Data Center, a spin-off from the Students for a Democratic Society, is listed as a Corporate Watch affiliate. Ralph Nader's Multinational Monitor is also listed. Other progressive socialist Marxist organizations with links to TRAC and CorpWatch include the Rainforest Action Network, Sweatshop Watch, and the Sierra Club. For Kavanaugh and others at TRAC and CorpWatch, the root of all evil lies in the capitalist world, which is driven by profit-salivating multinational corporations. The corporate encirclement of the planet is the inevitable result of the ongoing globalization process. Transnational corporations weave global girdling webs of production, commerce, profit-driven culture, and finance. These economic units face little or no opposition as wealth is concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. Kavanaugh and his merry band of like-minded progressive socialist Marxists argue that the transnational corporations are following a neoliberal economic pathway that exploits the absence of democratic systems of global governance. Saul Landau. Saul Landau has always been a passionate patriot of the highest order, or at least former senator and presidential candidate George McGovern says so. On the other hand, former communist Ronald Radosh believes that after the 1959 Cuba Revolution, Saul would become perhaps America's most ardent Castro admirer. David Horowitz says that Landau had volunteered himself as an agent of the Castro regime. Saul Landau has been rumbling around IPS and TNI for decades. It seems that others have worked hard to keep him occupied and employed. He has a flashy temper, judging from some of his interchanges with IPS TNI insiders. His connection is perhaps solidified by the fact that he and Cora Weiss attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison at the same time. He filled in as head of TNI after Orlando Leitlier was assassinated in 1976. Saul Landau had a bad day on September 21, 1976. Not only did he lose his colleagues Orlando Leitlier and his aide Ronnie Carpen Moffat, who were assassinated by carbomb in downtown Washington, D.C., but the blast and fire from the explosion that killed them instantly did not destroy Leitlier's briefcase. The briefcase was stuffed with documents linking Leitlier at the height of the Cold War with the Soviet Clandestine Intelligence Service, KGB, and the KGB-controlled Cuban Intelligence, the DGI. Orlando Leitlier, head of the IPS overseas arm TNI, had been working for the KGB and DGI for more than a decade. In addition, Leitlier was hand-carrying a letter from Saul Landau for Pablo Armando Fernandez, head of Cuba's intelligence service, the DGI. Landau's letter to Fidel's intelligence chief discussed his Jamaica work and was accompanied with articles and a film supporting the pro-Castro Manley government. Landau also wrote, "I think that the time has come to dedicate myself to making propaganda for American socialism. It is still a forbidden word here, but eventually someone or some group of people will have to put it together with a serious political movement. We cannot any longer just help out third world movements and revolutions, although obviously we shouldn't turn our backs on them, but get down to the more difficult job of bringing the message home." In 2008, co-directors Robert Borisage and Roger Hickey did just that. They turned the Progressive Socialist Marxist Campaign for America's Future into a serious political movement, guiding Barack Obama's run for the White House. This is also Saul Landau's propaganda dream come true. Orlando Leitlier. Chilean President Salvador Allende fell into popular disfavor almost immediately after his election in 1970. He received only 36% of the vote. Price fixing, nationalization of industry, and other socialist measures threatened to destroy the country's economic base and triggered a severe recession and inflation. Allende's efforts to gag the opposition press in 1973 was declared illegal by the Chilean Supreme Court, while the country's Chamber of Deputies condemned Allende's effort to impose a totalitarian governing order on the Chile. During his tenure, President Allende welcomed Cuban assistance to establish a Soviet-style intelligence apparatus, including informers on each block. When the regime was toppled by the military forces on September 11, 1973, Leitlier had become the Minister of Defense and was arrested. Released after a year, Leitlier went to Caracas, where Saul Landau telephoned and offered him a fellowship at IPS. The IPS-TNI connection with Fidel Castro's intelligence service, the DGI, is most fully exposed by S. Stephen Powell in his 1987 book Covert Cadre, and secondarily by James L. Tyson in Target America. The documentation of this long-suspected linkage and other important intelligence relationships entered the public domain in a rather peculiar way. Orlando Leitlier, a member of the Chilean Socialist Party in exile and director of TNI, was assassinated in Washington, D.C. by a car bomb that exploded while he was en route to the Institute for Policy Studies on the morning of September 21, 1976. The explosion killed Leitlier and an aide, Ronnie Carpen Moffat, and injured her husband. Leitlier's briefcase, however, was recovered from the damaged vehicle. The papers in the briefcase were photocopied by the FBI as a part of their investigation before the originals were returned to his wife, Isabel Leitlier. Meanwhile, Saul Landau and others cleaned out Orlando's files at his IPS office ostensibly to eliminate the chance that they could be used to compromise the resistance inside Chile. S. Stephen Powell's covert cadre provided his countrymen a needed insight into the operations and methods of the Institute for Policy Studies. He concluded his case study of Orlando Leitlier with a telling statement. The case of Orlando Leetlier provided hard evidence of the connection between Cuba and the IPS. Leetlier worked as an agent of influence under the Cuban DGA while directing IPS's transnational institute. Philip A.G. forced to resign from the CIA in 1968 for boozing and making boorish moves on the wives of American embassy personnel, Philip A.G. refused a return ticket from Latin America to the United States. His whereabouts for the next 5 years remained ambiguous, but he did make 5 trips to Cuba, one of which lasted for 6 months, to conduct research for his expose of the CIA, Vasily Semenov, chief KGB officer who held oversight responsibility over the Cuban intelligence service. The DGI took a great interest in AG's book, Inside the Company, a CIA Diary. In the book, AG recognized the Cuban Communist Party, Michael Locker of the North American Congress on Latin America, NACLA, Nicole Sulk, and John Gerasai. As S. Stephen Powell tells the story in Covert Cadre, AG racked up an impressive score of disinformation successes by spoon-feeding U.S. journalists. In February 1981, AG issued a critique of a State Department white paper on El Salvador, especially its exposure of arms transfers from the Soviet Union and its East European allies. Step 1 of the disinformation plan was placing AG's independent analysis and counterspy in the Covert Action Information Bulletin to attract the attention of Western journalists. Step 2 was use of the alternative media, left-wing, including such propaganda organs as Mother Jones, Village Voice, The Nation, and The Progressive. This technique is similar to running a chum line to give the fish just enough to trigger their taste buds. Third, the big-time trolling began, and for AG, it was not long before he started landing some very big fish. The first was the Wall Street Journal's Jonathan Quitney, followed by Robert Kaiser at the Washington Post. Both ran as page one stories. The jailbreak was on as America's journalists stormed the gates to gather more disinformation from other AG outlets. Rail Gene Isaac and Eric Isaac state the case very simply. Journalists are ready to believe the most improbable charges against institutions they distrust. As AG said, Washington Post reporters are among the large number of working journalists from virtually all the major print and electronic media in the country who call upon us daily for help, research, information, and of all things, names of intelligence operators in connection with articles they are writing. AG died in Havana on January 7, 2008.